All right, we have one case on our 9:30 docket, Bradshaw versus Bennis. If the clerk will please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Daniel Banks to argue for the appellate, and Ms. Page will continue to argue for the appellate.
All right, Mr. Bates.
Morning. May it please the court, Dan Bates, along with my partners Gary Moots and Rob Kelly for Betty Lou Bradshaw. Hopefully the court is aware that this is the fourth argument in this case. We haven't gotten in front of a jury yet. We're hoping to be able to do that this morning. The subject is subject matter jurisdiction, which can neither be presumed nor waived. This is the last phase, the second of the two interpleader actions that were filed while this case, the underlying case that is, was on appeal in this court. I think that one element that may have largely been ignored, and of the three lines of analysis as to why Judge Walton didn't have jurisdiction to make any distribution, certainly of any of the interpleaded funds, is the fact that this court has exclusive jurisdiction. The law is well settled that when a subject matter is on appeal and is the subject of a valid and timely filed appeal, the trial court loses its plenary power. This court is vested with exclusive jurisdiction. Neither the steadfast royalty holders before them nor now Mr. Bennis have any answer to that. Why? Because it's unassailable, it's undeniable that because of Bradshaw's pleadings and causes of action in the trial court for constructive trust, for reformation of the very oil and gas lease that has produced the proceeds from production that is under dispute and under analysis, all of this with the same parties were in the trial court. Therefore, it's undeniable that this Court of Appeals then has exclusive jurisdiction over the lease, over the proceeds for production, to the exclusion of the trial court. The only way then that the trial court, after the August 13th, 2010 final judgment and the underlying case, would have any continued jurisdiction would be under some enforcement analysis. However, that's not possible in this case because Bradshaw superseded the underlying judgment in the underlying action. Another fact that Bennis has no answer for, as did the steadfast royalty holders before them, because because the judgment was superseded, that divested Judge Walton of any jurisdiction to do anything with the proceeds from the production under the subject and disputed lease by way of some enforcement analysis.
Okay, will you clarify a couple of things? The interpleaders, there were two separate ones, and they were both filed before the final judgment was actually entered. Is that correct?
No, Judge Livingston. They were filed after the final judgment was rendered. And we're talking about the August 13th, 2010 final judgment in the underlying action. The one that said that this is a final judgment, it takes care of all claims, is to all parties, all relief not expressly granted herein is hereby denied. It's that one. While that was on appeal in this court, that's when Range, in response to a demand by Steadfast to release the funds, then parroted by Bennis, who also wrote a letter to release the funds, that's when Range filed the two interpleader actions, the one for the steadfast royalty holders for about $3 million, and then later, shortly thereafter, the one for Bennis that was about $1.3 million. So under both lines of analysis, first, this court has exclusive jurisdiction over all those proceeds. Second, there is no enforcement jurisdiction that remains vested in the trial court because we superseded that judgment. The third line of analysis is the preclusive res judicata effect of that August 13th, 2010 judgment because it denied all relief.
But Mr. Bennis didn't have any affirmative relief pled, did he?
He did not file a formal counterclaim, that's true. However, a couple of lines of analysis there. First, perhaps he should have, he certainly could have, and also it's undeniable that every step of the way in the trial court, Mr. Bennis made the same analysis, presented the same arguments, presented the same proof, in fact, in the trial court that he should be entitled to the proceeds from production under the lease because he held title to the non-participating royalty interest, that because he was a royalty owner, he ought to get that. And of course, even though he had a general denial to our claims, he did have a request for general and such other relief at law and equity to which he showed
entitled. Everybody has that in their pleadings.
I'm sorry?
Everybody has that in their pleadings. That doesn't then say that he was denied something that you think maybe he should have filed by the final judgment in this case.
I put that in every pleading to make sure that I'm never left out. If there's something that I should have pled, I mean, I understand it's routine, but just because it's routine doesn't mean that it doesn't have any legal efficacy.
But you're saying that we should then infer that he actually pled something by that and he was denied that affirmative relief?
No, I'm saying that he took the position every step of the way of his entitlement. The fact that he actually hadn't formally pleaded it might have afforded us some benefit had we done some special exception, but the case didn't get that far. But you can't correctly say that he didn't take the position that he was.
Well, of course he took the position. He was being sued by your client, and she wanted what he thought was his. But that doesn't put him in the same position as the other royalty people who are claiming royalty interest in the other interpleader, does it?
He is in the same position because Range has $1.3 million of his money suspended, and he wanted it, and he asked for it in the trial court, just as the Steadfast royalty holders had $3 million suspended in the trial court. Now, yes, the case didn't get perhaps that far progress, and Mr. Bennis could have, and under the compulsory counterclaim rules, probably should have made a claim for affirmative relief, as did the Steadfast royalty holders formally. But I don't see that the position that Mr. Bennis was in was any different. But that's just the third line of analysis on the jurisdictional question. Maybe there is a distinction with the third line, but there can't be any distinction between the first two lines, and that is this court and not Judge Walton had exclusive jurisdiction over these proceeds via the appeal, and enforcement jurisdiction was out the window because of the supersedis of that judgment. Therefore, Judge Walton's action in distributing these funds is repugnant to and interferes with the jurisdiction of this court. Let's assume, for example, that Range was getting ready to go bankrupt, and that creditors of Range were coming after these proceeds. Certainly, this court could have instructed Judge Walton to place those proceeds in that court, in the registry of the trial court. I mean, the Court of Appeals routinely tells the trial courts, marshal these funds, do this with this funds, when that is on appeal and within the jurisdiction because this court really doesn't have a registry. Of course, it uses the trial court's registry.
You're saying that Judge Walton should not have allowed Range to place those funds in the registry of the court, correct?
I'm saying that there was no subject matter jurisdiction to do that, yes.
You didn't appeal that, though.
That's correct, because we're not hurt. In fact, we're benefited.
Okay, then because why are we arguing that? Why are you arguing that, that he shouldn't have done that?
Because it's the case, it's the law. He had no jurisdiction.
But you didn't appeal that.
subject matter jurisdiction can neither be presumed nor waived. It's like this, Justice Gabriel. In the $4.3 million that we believe a large portion of is ours is sitting in an account not bearing any interest under Range's suspension under the Natural Resources Code. When you put it in the registry of the 355th District Court, it starts earning interest. That's to everybody's benefit. We're not hurt by that. What we are hurt by is Judge Walton not abating the action in deference to the jurisdiction of this court, which we asked for, which we argued for, which we were denied. And therefore, because subject matter jurisdiction, as the court well knows, can be raised for the first time even on appeal, this is a red herring, this argument that we failed to spend more of Mrs. Bradshaw's money to appeal something that benefited her, in fact, and didn't harm her. I don't think that at all is sufficient to confer the trial court's subject matter jurisdiction. So yes, it is the case. Judge Walton didn't have the jurisdiction to grant the interpleader. We objected to that. That got overruled. But as far as do we appeal that, well, why would we? Because, number one, subject matter jurisdiction is not waivable. Number two, all the parties, including Bradshaw, benefited by the fact that this large sum of money finally began to earn interest after all these years.
So you're not objecting to Range's original interpleader of the funds, but what you're objecting to is allowing the parties, the successful parties below, to almost undertake a post-judgment garnishment? I mean, that's the net effect of the trial court's decision to distribute proceeds, isn't it?
Well, the net effect of the decision to distribute the proceeds is to interfere with the jurisdiction of this court, because this court should decide what happens to the proceeds. Of course, we're urging the court to reverse all this, remarshal the funds, order them be put back where it is, preserve the status quo, give us our day before judge and jury on the merits of our case. But that's what it is that we're asking be done. Now, was there another part of your question, Justice Lemmings?
No, but the follow-up that I wanted to get to was, you know, Trap Rule 24 allows both a trial court and our court to undertake certain things after a judgment's entered. So why do you not believe 24 gives a trial court authority to handle and work on, let's see, sureties, the amount and type of security or security and sureties, and if circumstances change, modify the amount and security required?
Well, the trial court did that. You'll recall that the trial court set supersedis and then reversed itself and denied us any ability to post more supersedis than we did now. The supersedis was in the interpleader part of it. So we tried to supersede that, and we were denied that.
But you did supersede the final judgment on the merits of the case.
The final judgment on August 13th, 2010, in the underlying action, yes, ma'am, we superseded that judgment. Now, that was for cost. I mean, it was a take-nothing against us, but it awarded cost against us. And we superseded that, but we decided in our brief that once you supersede any part of the judgment, the whole judgment is there suspended. And therefore, theoretically, yes, we were in opposition to the fact of interpleader. As a practical matter, as what you appeal, We did elect to appeal the distribution because that's what harmed our client, not the fact that these funds were safe and secure in the registry 355th earning interest, while we say was under the exclusive jurisdiction of this Court of Appeals.
Let me ask you a question about your specific claim against Mr. Bennis. Is my understanding correct that Ms. Bradshaw is not claiming that she is entitled to any portion of Mr. Bennis's royalty? She is simply claiming that money as damages.
Our claim is this: we do not contest the fact that Mr. Bennis, by a royalty deed that was part of the overall transaction, and if the court has a question about how the transaction flowed, we have a chart that can address that. What we're saying is that there, we don't contest that he has his name on a deed and that he has title to a royalty. What our action then involves Mr. Bennis is about is that because, for example, Ms. Bradshaw had her royalty for 47 years before there was a penny because there was never any lease and never any production. Because of this illegally negotiated lease, there is a question about from whom the various percentages of proceeds ought to come. And therefore, we have asked that anybody who thinks they're entitled to the disputed portion, that this be held in a constructive trust. We fully expect Mr. Bennis to receive the benefits from the proceeds of production under this lease on the strength of his royalty. In fact, Mr. Bennis should have joined us, in our view, and sued Range and Steadfast, because they're the culprits that created all this. And maybe to make sure Mr. Bennis gets his, Range needs to give up some working interest. The Steadfast royalty holders may not get any of the benefits of their royalty. We don't know that yet because we haven't had a trial. And so that's why we're just simply asking the court to get us back to trial and put the money back where it belongs under the jurisdiction of this court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bates. And let's add an additional minute to Ms. Luking's time. She may not need it, but in case we have more questions.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court? I'm Paige Luking, and I represent Peter Bennis and Cleburne Bible Church. Both of these entities are before the court because of Betty Bradshaw's second appeal. What we're here today on is not the original proceeding. That is pending before the court. We were here last October. It's currently under submission. As the court recalls, my client, Peter, has a fixed non-participating royalty interest. It's fixed. Production, irrespective of a lease, if there is production on the Mitchell Ranch, my client is always going to have the same fixed royalty, irregardless of the lease. Betty Bradshaw's complaint since day one, 2007, has been she claims this lease is improper, she claims it's illegal, and she's trying to taint my client, Peter Bennis, with the actions of others. Uncontroverted, Bennis had no role in the lease. He didn't negotiate it. He has nothing to do with the lease. So if we go into Never Never Land, and if the case is reversed, the underlying case, and if Bradshaw is able to prove some type of conspiracy or illegality of this lease, her damages would come from the working interest. It wouldn't come from Peter Bennis. He's a fixed non-participating royalty interest that had nothing to do with this lease.
But who is the source of his interest? Who is his grantor?
Okay. He took, as a result of his assignment on April the 18th, 9 days before closing, he took his assignment from Steadfast as part of the consideration to assign his interest in the actual farm and ranch contract. He actually dealt with the land portion of this deal. But for Bennis, no one would have anything. there would have been no sale of the land. At that time, there was no lease. The closing was 9 days later. Now, we are asking this court to affirm Judge Walton's granting of the interpleader and disbursement of the funds for several reasons. Under Rule 43, the trial court had in rem jurisdiction to consider this matter. Once the judgment was entered in August of 2010, Bates and Bradshaw appeal the case. Range has competing claims. What is left out of most of the briefing is that Betty Bradshaw has had a less pendants on Bennis's property since about 2007, 2008. So Range has held his money up in suspense because of the less pendants of Betty Bradshaw, his former partner, Gary Humphreys, and this particular lawsuit, the underlying lawsuit. So when the constructive trust claim was found to be without merit and Bennis was the prevailing party, he continued to make his claims, which he's done from the beginning, to Range to pay his funds, what are due and owing to him. Range interpleads the funds into the Hood County Trial Court. The trial court properly and correctly granted that application for interpleader. That's step one of interpleader. You look at North Shore, Modesto, those cases talk about how the interpleader works. Judge Walton was correct in that. He had authority to do that. There was subject matter jurisdiction at that point in time.
Didn't she have the right to supersede that?
You know, she paid $413 on a cost bill, and we don't believe
that was in the other lawsuit.
In the underlying lawsuit. We don't believe Betty Bradshaw is a judgment debtor. We don't think she is in this particular case. No one has ever ordered her to pay anything. She has not had to have any property transferred from her to another person as a judgment debtor.
But that's because she claims she doesn't have the property.
That's right.
I mean, it's a unique scenario here because a third party is holding the money.
That's
originally.
Right. You're right, Your Honor. And Peter Bennis never had a counterclaim against Bradshaw because she didn't hold his money. So he had no duty to appeal. He had no reason to appeal. He was the prevailing party. This interpleader is totally separate. It's a separate lawsuit in connection with the removal of the less pendants, which Bennis filed motions for. We had to file several motions to remove the less pendants. Judge Walton ordered removal of the less pendants. At that point in time, there were competing claims between Gary Humphreys, Betty Bradshaw, and Peter Bennis as to these royalty funds. Then we have a summary judgment hearing, and if you look in the court's record, volumes 5 and 6, Bennis met his burden of proof. He established his good title, he established his deed, and it was proper that those funds be released that had been earmarked to him and to the church for their building funds. What's happening now is Bradshaw's trying to take something that's not hers. Counsel for Bradshaw stood here a year ago and said, they're not trying to take Bennis's interest. Well, they're trying to take his money, and that's not the status quo. In the event Bradshaw would ever win on appeal, she goes back and she can sue for her funds. But to continue to hold Bennis hostage and trap him in this litigation when she's been able to get her royalty interest since day one, even though she sued Range, and to prevent Bennis from getting his, that's just not right under the law. It's
aren't
not
you
right.
Going to come right back and say there's a res judicata in the interpleader action? If she files a separate or subsequent lawsuit, should she be successful at some future point in time?
Well, I think at this point in time, Betty Bradshaw's claims may be prevented under res judicata because she didn't seek. You know, in an interpleader, an equitable action under Rule 43, if you have a claim, you better make it. Those funds were in the court. She was on notice. She had plenty of opportunity to file and to seek those funds. She did not do that. The parties that sought the funds and filed summary judgment were my clients, Cleburne Bible Church, and Peter Bennis, and that's why those funds were appropriately distributed to them.
What about her mandamus action in this court?
In this particular case, as I'm recalling, Your Honor, what Betty Bradshaw did with respect to my client was she filed for an emergency relief, and this was like the last week of last year, and we think that this court properly ruled that there was no need to abate the proceedings. There was no need to put an emergency brake on this situation. Interpleader is, by law, an equitable process. The stakeholder who has competing claims is subject to multiple claims of liability. Range can get sued over and over and over. Well, what Range decided to do, and rightfully so, is interplead into the court where it's going to be safe, it's going to be protected. Well, at that point in time, the rules of interpleader apply, and Bradshaw never made a claim to those funds. She just doesn't want Bennis to get his money. She didn't want the church to get its money. She wanted to take what's not rightfully hers.
Well, she believes it is based on her underlying appeal.
Well, in her original action, yes, Your Honor. Well, those claims have already been defeated by summary judgment, this constructive trust. There are no cases that would impose that on a person like Peter Bennis, who had nothing to do with the lease. He didn't negotiate it. He had no role on it, and it is fixed. And in the event she did recover, her recovery should come from the working interest owners, not Bennis.
Well, sounds like to me that you're arguing the merits now. Let's just step back a minute and think about common sense. It seems to me that the reason that the funds remain in the registry of the court pending a judgment that's on appeal is in the event the judgment on the appeal goes back to the trial court. If it were otherwise, then the monies are dispersed, the monies can be given away, the monies can be gambled away, the monies can be lost. And should there be a different judgment after going back to the trial court, the monies aren't there anymore. And I mean, obviously, that's the concern from a common sense, big picture standpoint. It remains in the registry of the court until there's a final determination as to who they belong to, not a premature dispersal where the funds may disappear.
Well, Your Honor, in this particular case, and the case law is well established, if that's the case, then Bradshaw sues for restitution after the fact.
After the fact is gone. Let's say it's given all to the church and the church builds a new building. Well, or goes to Las Vegas and loses it all. I mean, it's gone. It's not there to be returned.
Well, in that event, if Betty Bradshaw did prevail down at the trial court, then she would have to execute against the church, and it would just be like any other case. That's her remedy, is a restitution action for those funds. But to hold the funds interpled that are Peter Bennis's rightful funds in an interpleader action.
Well, rightful, we're talking about everybody now. I'm throwing everybody in the same part. Rightful only after a full and final determination on the merits.
Well, we think at this point in time that Bennis is entitled to receive his funds. And we don't think that Betty Bradshaw's claims will ever be successful against
Bennis. You don't think so,
Bennis.
But that kind of depends on whether or not this court sends it back to the trial court, or if it goes from us to the Supreme Court and they decide whether or not it should return to the trial court. And then I guess there's an appellate process after that, after you have a trial on the merits. But until then, there isn't a final determination of who this money belongs to.
Well, Judge Walton did make a final determination, Your Honor, that of those interpled funds that were held under Peter Bennis's suspense number and those funds that were held under the church's suspense number, those funds rightfully belonged to Peter Bennis and to Cleburne Bible Church, because Betty Bradshaw made no claim as to those funds in the interpleader action. And that's what an interpleader is about. If you think those are your funds and you have a competing claim, you should lodge and file your pleadings and try to grab that money. That's not what happened here.
Why was this not an enforcement of the final judgment from August of 2010?
It's a separate lawsuit, Your Honor. And in this particular situation, Range was the party plaintiff for the interpleader case. So this is separate and apart from the original proceeding of that judgment.
Have the effect of that?
I don't really know that it does have the effect of that, Your Honor, because at some point in time, Betty Bradshaw keeps getting her money over and over and over, just making claims against Peter Bennis. I mean, we could be here 15 years and he would never see his money that he rightfully paid for, and the church would never see theirs. So We don't agree with that that's what that is, some type of end run on an enforcement of that judgment. We think this is a separate action. The impediments to the title of the Les Pendens were removed, and there was no reason to deny the interpleader action as started by Range, and there was no reason not to distribute those funds. In equity, that makes sense. In law, it makes sense. And looking at North Shore, the Modesco case out of Houston, the attorney's fees case, there was no reason. These claimants established their rights to the fund. And this court, as well as other courts of appeals, have held that a trial court has great discretion to control the funds that have been interpled. The Supreme Court said in Bryant, every reasonable doubt should be resolved in favor of the stakeholder's right to interplead. And that's what we have here. It allows the interpleader to use equity to get the money into the court so that the proper determination can be made and those funds can be released.
So your position is Rule 43 trumps Trap Rule 24.
Well, Trap Rule 24, and I can't remember, it's the Houston case. It's out of the 14th, I think. There's a long litany of cases. Also, it's one of Judge Brister's opinions that a court of appeals has a variety of remedies, such as, you know, enforcement of a judgment, a surety, calculation of the interest. So we think the trial court did have authority to do this. In this particular case, I think 43 is separate and apart from what was going on with Rule 24. And we really don't think that was a proper superseded judgment because it was a payment for court costs, $413 of the original proceeding. We don't really think she was a judgment debtor, Betty Bradshaw. So what we would ask the court to do at this point in time is to rule that Judge Walton's summary judgment in favor of Peter Bennis be affirmed and that the disbursement of funds be affirmed and that he be allowed to keep these funds as he has been during the pendency of the case and not be required to return them into the registry of the court. While it's an unpublished opinion, we think the court can look at Hearn, and I think Judge Enoch talked about it when he was here about a year ago. Bradshaw has never been ordered to transfer any money or property, and she hasn't been ordered to take any action. So we don't think she's a judgment debtor, and we don't think she had any absolute right to suspend that judgment. And there's ample authority under the interpleader cases to allow Peter Bennis to keep this money that is rightfully his and rightfully due and owing to him. So we'd ask the court to affirm.
All right. Thank you, Mrs. Luking. Mr. Bates, and y'all are going to present your chart, and this is the transfer of the interest. Is this correct?
Yes, Your Honor, because I don't think the question was answered. The grantor for Peter Bennis was Steadfast Financial LLC. And in the order in which this multifaceted escrowed transaction was set up and recorded, the property was conveyed to Wise Assets, who owned it, and it was Mr. Bennis and his partner Gary Humphreys that had a contract to buy the Mitchell Ranch. Then they assigned that to Steadfast, who then bought it from Wise Asset. Then you had the lease to Range. After that was recorded, the royalty deed to Mr. Bennis. So we have a dispute as to the efficacy of exactly whether this was lease royalty that was conveyed by royalty deed or whether it was, there would be no question had he gotten it from Wise Asset before this transaction, but he got it from Steadfast, and so this is part of the reason for the constructive trust. This issue has never been resolved. It's never been addressed because we haven't had our day in court yet, but Steadfast Financial LLC is the grantor to Mr. Bennis's NPRI.
And have you provided this chart to opposing counsel as well as the court in some format?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, the court asked before the in one of the cases for us to try to agree on a chart. We swapped all of these charts. There's no disagreement as to the sequence. There's a big disagreement as to the legal efficacy of what this means. But yes, this chart has been swapped around through all through the parties.
But my question is, does the court have a copy of that one? And I assume opposing counsel would have the opportunity to file their own chart if they disagree with
that. We certainly agree with that, Judge. Frankly, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
We can find out and we can get that, and certainly I'm agreeable to submit in.
Okay.
I'd like a yes or no answer.
Yes, sir.
There's no dispute as to the factual information on that chart. Yes or no?
Yes, there's no dispute. I think the answer is yes.
Okay. Then you'll leave the chart with us today when you leave.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
As they've done along the way, they just assume and presume subject matter jurisdiction. Because Rule 43 has an interpleader process, that doesn't mean that the court under this unique scenario had subject matter jurisdiction to entertain it. There's nothing in Rule 43 that talks about being able to do that while a court of appeals has the exclusive jurisdiction over the funds interpleaded. There's nothing in Rule 43 that trumps the jurisdiction of an appellate court. We believe that we had the right to supersede. We believe that we did. We know we superseded the underlying judgment. And one of our complaints is that we didn't have the right to even supersede the distribution of the funds. Now, I know Paige Luking, and I know she would never, ever say anything knowingly that wasn't so, and so I don't understand this. The claim that Ms. Bradshaw and the Bennis interpleader never made any claim to the proceeds is factually inaccurate. Look at 7 CR 2120 through 29, which is our cross claim against Mr. Bennis for these proceeds. In fact, Mr. Bennis specially accepted to that, pled res judicata, and pled for Rule 13 sanctions, saying that was frivolous because of the take nothing underlying action. Frankly, we did that to head off this argument that somehow we weren't competing for or claiming these funds. So I really don't understand that argument. I'm not saying that Ms. Luking would mislead the court. She would never do that. She's a fine lawyer. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying, though, is that they've not pled. Mr. Bennis has not given the court any case that was decided that's on point, because in each of the cases they cited, North Shore, for example, the insurance proceeds for that were interpleaded after the appellate process in the underlying case was resolved and you had a final judgment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bates. Ms. Luking, other counsel, we appreciate you being here as well, and we appreciate all your briefing and your arguments today. We will recess for a few minutes before our 10:30 case.